welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Another week has come and gone. Listen, folks, I'm going to address something real quickly on this program. We'll go even more in depth on for the weekend program. I know many of you listen know that not only do we dabble in true crime, but we also talk about the paranormal on our weekend programs. And at times you will hear things in the background that Tim and I do not always acknowledge. And I know many of you will write to us and say, oh my God, there was something scary in the background. Didn't you guys hear that cough? Didn't you hear that voice in the background? When we start the interview, our guest is online with us. He's just, he or she is just politely hanging there until we go to them. So from time to time, while Tim and I are talking, you may hear their dog bark. You may hear them clear their throat or sneeze. Perhaps one of their children will walk through the room and giggle. It's not always paranormal. It's not always dark demons from a strange dimension trying to come through your radio. It is, I promise you, mostly just audio artifact from the show. You know, feel free to continue to point out points of interest, and we'll certainly take a look at them. But that should give you a little insight, especially at the start of a show when Tim and I are chit-chatting for a few seconds. If you hear some weird noises in the background, it's most oftentimes our guest or somebody in their home preparing or just going about their daily routine. So I hope that answers your questions. I know we got inundated with emails this week on our last program on Sunday.
Oh boy, yeah.
From Darkness Radio. Yeah, there was quite a bit of audio artifact going on in the background because I think we had two guests on, total of three guests in two different places. You know, so we had a lot of background noise and craziness taking place. And I'm on the road right now, so recording these shows from hotel rooms. So from time to time, you are going to hear, as you probably hear now, people talking in the hallways behind me. It's frustrating, folks, but it's the best we can do in these crazy times when we're trying to get so much accomplished. But thank you for going along with us on the ride and having fun with us as we do it. True Crime Tuesday is here, as it is every Tuesday. We've got Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals coming up a little later. And keep sending in those stories from your areas, folks. If you've got stories of Denver Man or Chicago Man or Florida Man, we want to hear from you. Send in your stories to dave@darknessradio.com. If you are, in fact, a stupid criminal with a dumb crime in your past and you want to share that, you can also email me your story, and we may read those on an upcoming episode. We'll get to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals in a little bit. But right now, a brand new book has come out, Till Death Do Us, A True Crime Story of Bigamy and Murder. Patrick Gallagher is the author of this book. He is joining us today on the program. Patrick is an entrepreneur and businessman who retired in 2016 with the goal of writing the story of an infamous murder that occurred in Oregon. He's never published anything prior to this time, and this book is great, folks. I wanted to share it with you, bring him on, and give you a chance to hear this unbelievable tale. Thank you so much for joining us today, Patrick.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Now, you have a kind of a unique connection to this case. Why don't you introduce our listeners to that aspect?
Well, yes. When I was a child, I grew up living next door to my grandparents. And both my dad and my grandfather were attorneys in Oregon. And but before I was born, my grandfather was the lead defense attorney on a murder case. It was one of the most infamous murder cases in Oregon history. The defendant was a woman named Gladys Broadhurst, and my grandfather helped with her defense.
And that's who we're here to talk about today. So let's take us back. Now, how far back does this story go with Gladys and her very unusual life?
Well, it goes back all the way from the beginning for her life. She was born into a family of five. She was the middle child, the only daughter. The others were boys. But Gladys, she had a different kind of relationship toward men. And her first marriage occurred when she was just shy of turning 21. She got married for the first time. But something about that marriage was very wrong because within a year, she was already divorced from that first husband.
Really? Now, looking at her life leading up to this point, and realizing that she's a serial wedding planner, if you will. Right. What do we know about her life? Was it topsy-turvy? Was it abusive? Was there something going on that she was seeking?
She said once that she was used to beatings. So we don't know any of the details, but that does imply that something in her years growing up was rather violent.
Now, Gladys gets married for the first time at just the age of 20, barely makes it through the first year. Is there any indication to what broke up that first marriage?
No, there's not. And when I wrote the book, my first thought was to fictionalize all these marriages. But I decided that the listeners and the readers of my book really needed to know just the true facts. And so I have all of her marriages, and there were many of them, and the dates, but I don't have a lot of detail about the early marriages, about what transpired. But I do make some conjectures in the book based on some of the facts I know.
Well, as she moves through her life, is it filled with misery and tragedy, or does she seem to have a pretty decent life, but she's just always seeking that love and approval?
You know, I think you've nailed it there, Dave. Her life was good. The husbands she married were, from all appearances, very good men. But there's something in Gladys that just can't be satisfied with the man who loves her now. She's always looking, always searching for something else. And that's why her marriages all lasted a very brief amount of time. Seems like as soon as she conquered one man, then the question was, who can I find next?
It was more about the chase for her.
Well, that's my impression. You know, I'm just reading between the lines on the facts that I know, but it seems like what she really loved most was courting, dating, finding men, having men be enamored with her and want to marry her. And once she had them, then it was on to the next one.
Did each husband know of her past? Were they aware how many times she had been married?
I don't believe so. I think one of her methods was to keep her history as secretive as possible. But some of them did. For example, her second marriage, which only lasted, probably roughly around a year. That was in Utah. First marriage was in Idaho in 1927. Second marriage was in Utah in 1928. There was a big gap between her second and third marriage, but all appearances were they were separated less than 3 years after the marriage. And then she spent some time going with her family. She was a musician. And she was a very good singer and a piano player, and she seemed to have toured with her family in their family band called the Ralph's Novelty Orchestra. And that gives me a clue, because it seems to me, Dave, that very talented people sometimes have unique challenges in their personalities.
It would seem so, but boy, you just kind of opened a whole new window onto this case by talking about the fact that she is and was part of a musical act. And, you know, we joke about it, but you hear, you know, something that carries through today for musicians on the road, that their love lives are quite strenuous. Mm-hmm. They don't always stay faithful to a lot of the relationships or marriages that they're a part of. And, you know, it just makes you wonder, is there a part of that road, that longing, that loneliness in between shows that, you know, it fulfills, it's exciting, it's dangerous, it's a challenge. And then once you've kind of accomplished that bit, it's time to roll on. It's time to, you know, to pick up and go to the next town. And do we see any of this kind of activity from any other member of her family from this touring orchestra?
No, we don't. her brothers, from all appearances, had good marriages and were faithful, and she just seemed to be the unusual one out of the group. But remember, she's the only daughter. She may have been very much spoiled, and maybe we're talking in the 20s and 30s here. Women and men just, they live different lives, much more than than today.
Was her family aware of her kind of need for attention and affection from all these men, or did she even keep that separate from them?
Well, they didn't know all the details, I'm sure, but they did know about the various husbands, and she would bring them by to go visit her brothers.
Was she and her family pretty well-to-do with this musical touring act, or were they just kind of, people of the time? It was enough to get them by and get them from city to city.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that they were unusually wealthy. I think they made a living with this process, and they didn't continue that. Of course, World War II came into play, and all of the brothers were involved in the war one way or another. And then after the war, one brother ran what we would today call an RV camp, but in those days they didn't have RVs. They had cabins and tents, and people would drive to them and spend a week vacationing. And so the musical tours didn't last all their lives, but it did for a number of years.
During her time traveling with the band and, going in and out of towns, did there seem to be a boy in every port as well, or were these aspects of her story kind of kept more secretive?
They were definitely kept more secretive. And I don't have any information about any relationships she had during those times. But just based on the rest of her life, she must have been involved with men at various times. And that seems to be the pattern of her life. She's always looking for another man. So she didn't get married to any of those men, but my guess is that she did have a lot of relationships.
How many times throughout her life leading up to this kind of nefarious ending, how many marriages in total did she have?
Well, the doctor who was her husband, who was murdered, was her sixth husband.
So she, and six times. Are there any, do you think, that are in there that maybe fell by the wayside that maybe even you were unable to uncover?
Well, of course, you don't know what you don't know, but I think I got them all. They're so close together, with the exception of that time traveling with the band, there couldn't have been anybody else in between there. For example, her third and fourth husbands both worked for the same company in Westwood, California. They were loggers or lumbermen, not loggers, but lumbermen. There is a big lumber mill there, and both husbands worked in the mill. And so my supposition is that she had an affair with number four while still married to number three. And after they got married, they moved away, and I'm guessing that's because of the problem.
That seems strange. I mean, just to be a part of this. Now, you got insights into letters during this last marriage and the relationships, letters that had been hidden away for over 70 years. Were you able to uncover any of the other letters and things to give you insights into her relationships with these men? And, any history of abuse, any history of any kind of neglect, anything that would give us any more insight into this woman and her desire to keep moving through people?
No, all the letters that I have relate to husband number six, or there was a husband number seven also.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
And go ahead.
Now, these marriages that she's moving through, what is the longest marriage that she seems to be a part of?
Probably 2.5 years. a lot of them lasted a year or year and a half or so.
And were there any children, offspring at all of any of these relationships?
No, she never had any children.
Was she incapable, do you know, of having children, or just something she was very cautious about, making sure she didn't find herself in the family way?
Well, back in the 30s and 40s, there weren't many options on how to prevent pregnancy. So my guess is she was unable to bear children. But that's only an assumption.
Okay. All right. Now, as these marriages progress and she's moving, are they all, except for the two that you mentioned that were in the same state that kind of worked, were they all kind of spread out? Or, you know, did she start to settle in one area?
Well, she lived in Idaho and Utah and Nevada and California for most of her life. The doctor that she married, who was husband number six, had been her doctor 20 years earlier when she was married to husband number one or two. And I believe, again, I'm doing a lot of reading between the lines on my consideration here, but I believe she at the very least had a romantic relationship with the doctor, because that was clearly stated later. There very well may have been some infidelity there. And the net result was that she moved away from that town, and so did the doctor. So my guess is something really blew up there.
Okay, so that was kind of a strange love tryst that didn't end well, but would come back to bookend her story.
That's right, that's right.
Now, throughout all of this time, was there ever any kind of indication to a dark side that Gladys had?
There is a clue. She was quoted as saying, "I hate men and I hate sex, and I don't know why I ever got married again." So, you know, the real question is, what did she think of men in general? What was her attitude towards men? It seems like she treated them all quite shabbily.
That is so bizarre. Do you think she was fighting inner demons? Was she perhaps lesbian and trying to make things work with men and just couldn't make that connection?
Well, I don't see any evidence of any strong relationships with women either. I think she was a very troubled woman. I had a friend who I related the story to say, borderline personality disorder. That's what it sounds like to me. Well, you know, I've heard that term before, but I never knew what it meant. To me, borderline means marginal, you know, not such a big deal. But after that friend said that, I went and did a little research on borderline personality disorder. It's a major psychotic illness, and it causes all kinds of very irrational behavior and describes Gladys Broadhurst pretty well.
So this borderline personality, can you go into that a little bit more deeply so we have an understanding? Is that something that people would call narcissism now?
No, I think you would call it psychosis now. It causes, and I am no expert on it, so you might want to do some reading on it, but it causes you to act very irrationally at times, and especially in your relationships with other people.
Okay. She's moved through these. Now, at any point, is she married to one while married to another, or is it just constantly moving from one to another after a divorce?
Well, you know, I think that especially the middle marriages in California back in the 40s, 30s and 40s, when you got a divorce, they issued what was called an interlocutory decree, which meant you're divorced, but it doesn't become final for 1 year. So 1 year after the interlocutory decree, the divorce becomes final. She never waited 1 year between marriages, with the exception of the one time when she was traveling. So in a sense, I think she was kind of a serial bigamist in that sense, but she became a true bigamist between husbands number 5 and 6, and number 6 was the doctor. And
for the most part, it wasn't like she was holding two secret lives. It wasn't like she was married to Dave and Tim simultaneously, where we thought we were the only men in their lives and thought we had a happy marriage. This was just she had ended one, then moved on to the other, although the divorce had not been finalized yet.
Well, no, that's true for the earlier ones, but between husbands number 5 and 6, she absolutely was married to them both at the same time and trying to keep that a secret from each.
Wow. Well, talk to us about marriage number 5. Tell us about her husband and how they met and a little bit about their lives, if you would.
Well, number 5 was a soldier. Actually, he was a geologist, but they married just after World War II, began right after Pearl Harbor. And as many men who were going off to war did, he wanted to get married to her before he left. So they got married at Fort Ord in California on the post in the chapel there. And then he went off to war. So they were actually married for a number of years, but they weren't together all that much. And so once he went to war, she was kind of in hog heaven. She got his paycheck. She had the name of being married to him, but she was free to go on dates, to go out and party and go to bars and live a pretty high life, all while her husband was in serving in a war.
Okay. All right. Now, is this something, do you think, you know, kind of looking at the times when there were women whose husbands were off at war, is this really kind of a surprise what's the right word I'm looking for here? Were there many women, do you think, that were partaking in relationships, perhaps even other marriages with men while their men were away? Not sure if they'd ever see their husband again.
My impression is that that is not normal, that usually the women were very proud of their husbands for serving in the war and very proud to support them and did everything they could to be faithful. You know, you do hear about men that went off to war who had girlfriends and came home and discovered their girlfriend and married somebody else. But most married men, I think, came home to faithful wives, but not Mr. Lincoln. That was husband number 5's name. Was Lincoln, and he came home and of course tried to resume a normal life with her, but it didn't last long after that.
Well, how long into her marriage to Mr. Lincoln did she meet up with her 6th husband and begin that relationship?
Well, her 6th husband was a doctor that she'd known 20 years earlier, and after just a few months of being at home, the marriage was not going well between Lincoln and Gladys, and he filed for divorce based on mental cruelty. So you can see that she wasn't treating her husband well. But he really wanted to make the marriage work. So 5 days after he filed for divorce, they reconciled. 20 days after that, she took a trip to Reno and married the doctor. So all the time that she was married to Lincoln, not all of the time, but a great deal of the time she was married to Lincoln, she was already corresponding with the doctor and reestablishing that romantic relationship that they'd had 20 years earlier.
When we look back at these other divorces, who instigated most of these divorces? Was it her or was it the man?
I think it was her, but I think that the marriages went so badly, it could have been some of the men.
All right. Yeah, I wasn't sure how that works. All right. So she marries her 6th husband while still married to the 5th husband. The 6th husband, does he think that she is divorced or she's finalizing a divorce? Give us some insight into his world and introduce us to the good doctor, if you don't mind. Tell us a little bit about his life and backstory.
Well, he just in order to develop this relationship with him, and he was a very wealthy doctor. He was a chiropractor, but he also owned two farms. He owned a 160-acre dairy farm, which he did not operate. He leased the land out to a dairyman. And he owned a ranch that was in Idaho, and he owned a ranch in Oregon that was thousands of acres. So he was a very prosperous man. And so in order to attract him, she needed several stories or subterfuges to help her deal with the fact that she was still married to Lincoln. And so one of them was she claimed that Lincoln had been killed in the war. So as far as the doctor knew, she was a widow. And the other one was that she was about to inherit a very large inheritance. And so I think the reason she came up with that false story was to convince the doctor that she wasn't a gold digger. She wasn't after his money.
So the doctor's just taking it on face value. Oh, yeah, my husband's dead. But even though there's never been a real funeral for him or anything along those lines, he just is ready to move back on with the relationship that they started 20 plus years ago.
Dave, I think one of the big questions, or several of the big questions of this book, are why did Gladys act the way she did? You know, what kind of a woman is she? How can she go through all these marriages and treat these men so badly, and then ultimately get involved with this doctor that ended so badly? That's one of the questions. But the other question is, why is the doctor so naive, so gullible? He's just madly in love with her. And when she acts very strangely and does things that are very inappropriate, he just is unwilling to accept that she's an evil person. You know, he gives her more than the benefit of the doubt every time.
So he's now, how old is he at this point when they connect and get married eventually?
Well, he's 51 and she's 40.
So okay.
He's quite a bit older than her. And he has been married once previously and divorced. But he'd been unmarried for a number of years when he married Gladys.
Now, remember, folks, as much as we're covering in this story, there's a lot more to the story. We're giving you a very interesting glossary overview of the details of the different people, the stories, the time, and the setting. Patrick Gallagher, our guest, the book Till Death Do Us, a true crime story of bigamy and murder. We have a link, so make sure you get the book and read it. Go even more in depth into this insane story. And when you buy the books, folks, rate and review them for the authors. Make sure that you rate and review them, because that helps elevate their presence on places like Amazon.com, and more people will hear about the books and be able to find them as well. So he seems to be the kind of guy who either he thinks finally my true love, the one I should have followed through with 20 years ago, she's finally here. This is it. Maybe he's overlooking some of the idiosyncrasies because listen, she's a widow. She's gone through, a crazy life. She's been on the road. I'm just, I love this woman. He's going to kind of see past all of this.
Yeah. And he's just unwilling to accept that there's something wrong with her, I think. And I don't know why he's like that. I don't know why he doesn't say, wait a minute, this isn't okay.
Especially because he's a doctor, right? You would think that he might see that there is some mental acuity issues here with this woman. But again, they say it, and it's true, right? Love is blind. How many people have stayed in a relationship much too long hoping things will get better, hoping that you'll be the one that person changes for, or hoping that you can help change that person, only to find that, a year, 5, 10, 20 years later, you're left in kind of disrepair and realizing that was, an ill-fated relationship from the beginning. But this doctor is trying to make the best of the life that he's now got and finally with the woman that he loves. So if she's still married, how is she explaining being gone and back and forth between her fifth husband and sixth husband.
Well, she told her fifth husband, Lincoln, that she was just going to Reno to visit family. She gave the doctor a story. It's a very fantastic story. She said that her husband had been killed, but that he had a twin brother who had learned of her impending inheritance and was trying to assume the identity of her dead husband and claim that inheritance. And so I think she told that story simply to prevent, if the doctor learns about the husband, that he would then think, oh, this is not really the husband. This is the evil twin brother.
So she's writing the plot lines for major soap operas 20 years before they would ever air on TV.
That's right. I mean, this is really a soap opera.
Holy cow.
And she's really working hard to keep the doctor from learning about the husband down in California, Lincoln.
You've got it, right? I mean, you've got to think it's so twisted that it's genius that she's come up with this concept. She's going to sell this man on this relationship, on this their relationship, and on what has happened to her in the past. She is so vested in it that she's created this insane backstory that probably sounds so incredible, but because it's based around money, this evil twin wants the inheritance. He's going to try to take over and do this. We understand how people are. And it was a time in history. And I'm explaining this for listeners that are living in the 21st century that might have a hard time grasping this, but living in a time, you know, war has come and gone. Our nation is kind of at odds. Money is tight. You know, the average income is what, like $12,000 a year or something ridiculous. So if there's an inheritance to be had, it's more understandable of how something like this could take place.
Yes, and $12,000 a year is probably a pretty good salary. A lot of people were living on less.
See, Tim, now, if you and I were alive back then doing what we do now, we'd be millionaires with that $12,000 a year radio job we've got.
I know, right?
Right? See, we're born out of time, my friend. all right, Patrick. So she's doing her best. Does the good doctor start to smell a skunk at any point during this story? Or is he just, you know, kind of invested in her tale and believing that this crazy deceit is taking place?
He never figures it out, and he should have, I think. But I think he's so committed to loving this woman and doing what's right for her that he just refuses to accept the bad side or the bad interpretation of any event.
We are so capable of doing dumb things in the name of love, and this is just another glaringly obvious view of that. All right, where do things suddenly jump the rails, Patrick, and turn from serial marriage to murder?
Well, the doctor messed things up for her in one sense. He kept sending letters to her at her home in California, which she tried to intercept, but Lincoln finally got one of the letters and realized that she'd committed bigamy, and things really blew up then. And so she called the doctor and told him to come rescue her from the evil twin who was after her. And so the doctor rushed down from Oregon, where he was.
Wait a minute. The doctor. Now, this gives you some insight. The doctor's dumb enough to write to her at the home where she's living with this quote unquote evil twin and trying to deal with this storyline.
Right. Yeah. He sends letters to her. Wow. And Lincoln finds one, learns what's going on. So the doctor's in the middle of roundup, but he hurriedly dashes down to California and picks her up and takes her back to Oregon to the ranch. And the reason he does that is one of the other issues is Gladys does not drive. And The reason she doesn't drive, I think, it could be she just never learned, because back in those days, some women just didn't drive. But also, she was a drug addict. She had become addicted to a sleeping drug called Nimbutol. And I think as a result of that, she could not drive.
All right. So this, you can see this catalyst for bad things starting to take form now. What unfolds next?
Well, the doctor gets her up there, but Lincoln is, you know, he had filed for divorce earlier, and then they reconciled. So he goes back to his lawyer and he says, we need to upgrade this divorce and add bigamy. So they do that. They amend the divorce complaint, which needs to be served on her. And they know that she's in Idaho, so they send the documents to the sheriff in Idaho, who tries to serve her with these amended documents. The sheriff never catches her in order to do that, but she learns that he's looking for her. And so she realizes she has got to get back to California and get this divorce thing settled, or else the doctor will learn that she was still married when she married him. So she's got to get back to California. The problem is she doesn't drive.
Right. So what does she do next?
Well, she tells the doctor, I need to go down to California and settle some issues surrounding my big inheritance that's coming up. And the doctor says, how long are you going to be gone? And she says, well, 10 days, 2 weeks at the most. Oh, he says, I can't be gone that long. We're in the middle of haying, and I just can't be gone. Well, she says, why don't you have this ranch hand drive me down, whose name happened to be Gallagher. Just a coincidence, not a relationship of mine. But he was about the same age as Gladys, and the doctor thought, I don't think I want my wife going down to California with another man like that. That would not look good. And so they settle on a young 23-year-old cowboy that's an occasional laborer for the doctor on his ranch. And the doctor asks him if he'll drive Gladys back to California for this trip. And he's not too keen on it, actually. He doesn't want to do it, but the doctor persuades him. And so this 23-year-old cowboy, who, remember, Gladys is 40, quite a bit young. He's quite young compared to her. The doctor thinks it'd be safe to send Gladys to California with him as a driver. And they're only going to be gone for 10 days or 2 weeks. So that's the beginning of where the story really turns dark.
Yeah, I love that in his theory, you know, well, let's send her with a much younger, much more stable cowboy to be her driver. He doesn't see any issues in that. All right, they set this rendezvous up. She's heading home. What is this relationship, friendship, whatever it is she has with between her and her driver?
Well, the first night out, she starts seducing him. By the second night, they're checking into hotels as husband and wife. So the doctor's efforts to protect his wife from anything like that did not work. And so Gladys and the cowboy have a wonderful time traveling around California.
So talk to me about Gladys and give us a little bit more insight on her. And I mean, is this woman considered stunning for her time? Is she rich? Is she what is the allure that she has over so many men that she is able to just kind of at a whim just win them over and have them fall head over heels and do dumb things? This cowboy knew what he was getting into, and he knew she was married and had no problem playing this game. Talk to me about that, would you?
Well, Gladys was attractive. All the descriptions that I've read in newspaper articles about her describe her as attractive. But I have photos of her, and they're in the book. She's not stunning. You know, she's not like a movie star, in my opinion. She is an attractive woman. But in my opinion, when a woman really showers her attention on a man, he's just, that's an overwhelming thing for a woman to be so forward with a man and so seductive to him. I don't think you have to be a movie star to be extremely sexy and seductive. And I think that was her strength, was she just really went after the men strongly.
So she kind of overwhelmed him with the charms. And it sounds like from the private letters that you uncovered, her sexuality, she certainly was willing to flaunt and use as she saw fit as well.
I think that was her weapon with men. I don't know if weapon's the right word, but that was her strength, or her power over men, was that she was attractive, yes, but she was very into physical relationships, I think. Even though she said later, I hate men and I hate sex, she certainly used men and she used sex on men.
Now, they're going there to deal with this aftermath of her divorce. She's trying to settle everything up. She's trying to keep things from the good doctor. She's now involved in a three-way tryst. Does she start planting the seed with this cowboy chauffeur that something drastic has to take place? Or does he think he's a hero and start formulating his own plan?
Oh, no. She was the instigator of it all. And one of the strange things about Gladys is she loves movies. And she and the cowboy go to a number of movies while they're on this trip. And is a movie called The Postman Always Rings Twice. And it's a story about a man and a woman, husband and wife, that own a diner. And an employee comes to work at the diner, and she has an affair with this employee, and ultimately they kill her husband. They go to that movie, and after they leave the theater, while they're driving, Gladys turns to the cowboy, and she says, "Gee, it's too bad something like that can't happen to the doctor." And she begins at that point grooming the cowboy to murder her husband.
Does he seem complicit at first, or is this something she knows she's going to have to really seduce him into?
Oh, she really had to talk him into it. He did not like that idea at all. He was not in favor of that. And of course, her plan involved him doing the actual killing, and he did not want to do that at all. But she had such control over him, such power over him. It goes back to her relationship with men, and she really seemed to dominate men, and especially this man who was 13 years younger than her, 17 years younger than her, and she really had him wrapped around her finger.
Okay. She plants the seed. He obviously takes the bait and decides he's going to go on. Talk to us about this cowboy, and what do we know about his life and past? Is this something far out? I mean, he's young, 23 years old. We're guys. We're, you know, stupid for love. There's nothing we wouldn't do for our women. We all say I would kill for her, but this guy is legitimately willing to kill.
He has a hard time doing it. I think there's no question that this cowboy, he never would have done such a thing had he not been under her influence. I think he was a decent guy. He was a hard worker. He didn't have a lot of education. He only had 1 year of high school. His dream in life was to be a cowboy. And in fact, while they were on this trip to California, they went to a rodeo, and he won the first prize for the bronc riding contest. So that was his dream in life, was just to be a cowboy, work on ranches, and he never would have done such a thing had it not been for her.
When she gets him to this mindset. You said it was hard for him. Was he on board and ready to do this for her? But as it came time to actually commit the murder, he started to chicken out. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, he was really having a hard time with this. And she actually, as the time approached to actually commit the murder, she went out and bought a couple of bottles of whiskey and gave them to him to help him steel himself and get himself up for the job.
A little liquid courage.
That's right. She knew he was having a hard time with this.
All right. Talk us through the murder and kind of set the stage for us that day. Do you believe that Mr. Lincoln had any idea what was going on? Did he think that there was reconciliation in their future?
Well, no. And Lincoln, of course, is pretty much out of the picture by now. The divorce is proceeding, and so it's the doctor in Idaho that she's wanting killed, and again, he has no clue, and so Gladys and the cowboy actually have multiple discussions about what's the best way to commit this crime, and they come up with a number of theories and abandon them, and finally they settle on one where the cowboy is going to waylay him on a deserted road and kill him at that time.
Is the doctor self-aware at all that there's something going on, that there may be an issue?
Well, he should have been. He should have been. I mean, there's so many things that happened that to me are big red flags, but he never seems to act as if he has any clue. You know, he's sad. I have letters from him where he indicates his sadness at how she's treating him, but he then promptly says, but I trust you completely. He just refuses to lay any blame at her door.
All right. So how does the murder end up going down?
Well, just as they planned. The doctor says one day, I'm going to the other ranch tomorrow. So she passes that on to the cowboy, and he goes out on that deserted highway and pretends that he's broken down on the side of the road and waits for the doctor to come by. When the doctor does come by, he flags him down and tells the doctor his car's broken down. When the doctor tries to help him, he kills the doctor.
Ends the doctor's life right then and there. Is there any remorse immediately from the cowboy? How does he deal with this? You know, it's in one thought of getting something done and the other thought of actually doing it are two separate issues altogether. What was it like for him at that point?
Well, he testified later that he almost couldn't do it, that as he was about to strike the doctor, he did not want to do that, but he could hear Gladys in his mind saying, if you fail, don't even bother coming back. So he went ahead and proceeded with it.
Wow. And he didn't see an issue with that, right? That, hey, you know what? If my relationship is predicated on me killing somebody or I'm not welcome back and she's willing to put one husband down, how safe am I and for how long would kind of be my thought?
Well, that would be a wise decision to think like that. He didn't appear to. He was just so mesmerized by her and wrapped up by her. His only problem was he just wasn't that kind of man on his own, and it took her motivation and her persuasion to get him to do that.
Okay, the murder is committed. How soon do things start to unravel in their lives? Do they realize who's involved in this murder?
Well, it's just immediate. The doctor is discovered to be missing within hours, And people are searching. They find his pickup truck. They find his horse trailer. They find his horse. But they cannot locate the doctor. And so the search begins the night of the murder and continues for several days after that. The law officers, and one of the issues is this murder occurred right on the highway between Idaho and Oregon, so close to the state line that there was some question which state had jurisdiction. But it turns out that it was in Oregon, so Oregon had jurisdiction. So the sheriff from Vail, Oregon, which is the county seat there, and his deputies and some local police, they all got involved in the search, but it didn't take them more than a day or two to start suspecting Alvin and Gladys. They just seemed like the most suspicious people in the whole arena. They didn't shut the door on other possibilities, but they quickly begin to suspect this couple.
All right. Once justice is rained down and they are brought in, do they turn on each other? Do they stand by each other's side?
No. The cowboy becomes state's witness number one. And he gets a plea deal, which back in this time, plea bargains weren't really legal.
Isn't that weird to you that the guy that actually committed the murder is able to strike the deal on the person who conspired to do this?
And my belief is, and it's very clear, that the state and the law officers, the district attorney in the state, viewed Gladys as the evil person here. They saw that the cowboy was a pawn in her hands, and they really blamed her much more than they blamed him. And that's why they were willing to let him turn state's witness so that they could get her.
Wow. I don't know. As you stand back and you've got family and law, doesn't it seem misguided that we're loosening a little bit of the grip on the killer and just going for the mastermind of this? I mean, obviously she has a hand in this, but, you know, me saying, Tim, listen, you know what? Grandma's got to go, man. I need your help here. And you know, if you were really my friend, you'd do this for me. Me saying that and him being complicit and following through on that, I mean, it seems to fall a lot more on the shoulders of the murderer as opposed to the person thinking about it or planning it out.
That's not how the law saw it. And I think that's not how I see it either. In my judgment, she is the evil one here. And I just don't.
Oh, and don't get me wrong. Certainly she is. She's evil. She's manipulating people. She's taking advantage of her stance and circumstance. I get that. I'm just, like I said, it just baffles me. He could have walked away at any time. And the worst thing is, at his age, is he's out of an old girlfriend. And, yeah, you know, he can move on with his life and not be a murderer. And, you know, to be the one behind it, I don't know. You know, like I said, it just seems weird that there's any plea bargaining struck. Why not just nail both of these two to the cross and leave them out to hang? Or did they really need his testimony in order to, I don't know. I guess I don't know enough about the law to understand that I would think that in just prosecuting him and him trying to, you know, with the defense attorneys trying to play that angle of it, that would already tell the story that should crucify her and no deal should be struck. But I'm getting hung up on a small aspect of this. He becomes the eyewitness for this. What is his eventual crime? What do they nail him with and how long does he have to serve?
Well, in the 1940s in Oregon, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, the automatic penalty is the electric chair, execution. If you're convicted of second-degree murder, the automatic penalty is life in prison. So what they did is they allowed him to plead guilty to second-degree murder, which saved his life. And he was sentenced to life in prison.
Did he ever see the light of day, or did he legitimately spend his life in prison?
Well, Dave, life doesn't mean life. He served 10 years in prison.
Oh, unbelievable. Now, yeah. What about Gladys? What is, you know, her lover's flipped on her. Is she during this time trying to persuade him in any way? Has she got any connection to him to try to shut him up or get him to change his position?
Well, no, of course, she has no contact with him, no ability to have contact with him. He's in prison in Vail, Oregon. She's in prison in Idaho, where she was first arrested. And so she has no way of communicating with him whatsoever. And, of course, the sheriff and the DA are keeping him away from anybody that could have any connection with her.
How quick does her case go? And now, was your grandfather was an attorney? Was he on the prosecuting side, you said?
No, he was on the defense.
Oh, he was on the defense. Was that a tough row for him to hoe, to defend a woman that was this dark and evil?
That's a good question, Dave. You know, my dad was a lawyer and my granddad was a lawyer, and I know a number of lawyers that practice law that includes criminal defense. And every lawyer I've ever talked to has said very clearly that the law states that every defendant is entitled to a vigorous defense. And they see it as their bound and sworn duty to provide that best defense that they can. And so I've had a lawyer tell me that he forbade his client to tell him whether or not he really committed the murder he was accused of, because he didn't want to know. He wanted to take the murderer's story and run with it. But lawyers, they see their job as to give the best defense possible. And that's what the law requires.
Right. And I understand that has to be done. There has to be protection in it. I just didn't know if your grandfather was ever forthcoming about what it was like. And, you know, did he believe her innocence? Did he think she was this manipulated woman whose lover took it upon himself to commit this murder and then try to put it off on her when things went bad?
Yeah, I don't know, actually, the answer to that question, Dave. But I believe that he probably knew, you know, he probably recognized the truth of what Alvin was testifying to, but he still did his job of trying to help her, save her from execution.
How quickly does the jury weigh in on this case, and what is her eventual outcome?
Well, the trial itself lasted 3 full weeks. It took a real long time. It was a very extensive trial. It was, as I said, one of the most famous trials in Oregon, and it was carried nationwide. I found newspaper articles from the Boston Globe and from Phoenix and from Washington State about this trial. So it was a nationwide story. Lasted a long time, but the jury, when they went out, only took hours to come up with a verdict. They all agreed from the beginning. All 12 jurors agreed that she was guilty. They all were convinced of that. The only point of argument was whether they would convict her of first-degree murder or second-degree murder. And actually, no, I'm wrong there. Let me restate that. They all agreed she was guilty of first-degree murder. The only disagreement was what kind of punishment she should get. Because in the 40s, as I mentioned, first-degree murder automatically carried execution as the penalty, unless the jury specifically requested life in prison instead of the electric chair. And that was their disagreement. It took unanimous for the jury to go for execution, but it only took 2/3 of the jury. I don't know whether it had to be unanimous on life or not, but they finally all agreed to ask for life in prison instead of execution. And that was typical when the defendant was a woman. They had never executed a woman in Oregon up to that time.
Unbelievable. What a crazy case. I mean, were there a lot of twists and turns and surprises for you in uncovering the story and digging so deeply? And what was it like to uncover those letters that had been lost for 70 years?
Well, that was the big thing. And that's really what motivated me to write this book, is because I have a whole box full of love letters from the doctor to Gladys that never were found by the prosecution, never part of the trial, and were buried in a family trunk that I inherited for 70 years. Those letters are really the backbone of my book. And so when I read them, it's just amazing to me how the doctor reacted towards her, how she reacted towards him, and I just knew I had to write this book and get those letters out.
Well, I appreciate it. And again, folks, the book Till Death Do Us, A True Crime Story of Bigamy and Murder. Patrick Gallagher, our guest, that's the book. The link for that book is up in today's program. So make sure that you click on it, order that book, and please rate and review it. It's important, again, for all of our guests that you do that. You enjoy the content that they share with us on the show, and you want to go more in depth in the story and get a deeper, wider perspective on every player and what really took place, make sure you buy these books and read into them. Although we cover quite a bit in the hour or two that we spend together with our guests, we're still giving you just a very cursory look at the entire tale. There's so much more to be told, and I hope that you'll pick up the book Till Death Do Us and read it for yourself. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great chatting with you as well. Folks, you know what that means. It's time to kick open those case files. We've got them. You demand them. It's time to share dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim. Timmy, Tim, or Tim? Weird stories. Weird stories. A lot of weird stories. We're going to Vienna, Tim.
Okay.
Vienna calling, Tim. Where police have fined a man 500 euro. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Breaking wind in public. Maybe a social taboo, but it's not often that people face financial consequences for it, Tim. But that's the case for one man in Austria.
Yeah, Tim, Austria. I just want to pass wind. What's the problem? I was fined 500 euro. After doing so to police in Vienna earlier this month.
The city's police have defended the fine, saying it was for more than that. Of course, no one will be reported for accidentally letting one go. That's what Vienna's police department said on Twitter, responding after a photo of the charge sheet issued for violating public decency was shared on social media. The police department said the suspect had already behaved...
Yeah, the suspect already behaved in a provocative, in uncooperative manner.
That's when he was approached by police in the early hours of the 5th of June. He then rose from a park bench, Tim. Like the Terminator, Tim. Oh, looked God. At the officers and apparently intentionally released a massive intestinal wind in the immediate vicinity of the officers. I flick my nose at you and fart in your general direction. And as the suspect found, to his own cost, members of the city's police force prefer not to be farted at, Tim.
Yeah, no, we're going to cut that short. Nip it in the bud.
Or somewhere.
So, yeah. A man was fined $500 for farting in the vicinity of cops. Good God, Tim. I would be in prison, in debtor's prison for the rest of my life if that was the case.
That technically is assault on an officer.
Yeah. I think it's assault on anybody in the vicinity, especially if I'm going. Good God. Florida man carrying nearly 500 grams of weed. Tim tries to steal a plane to meet his girlfriend. He's an old romantic. That's all it is, Tim. Because the man told officers he needed to meet his girlfriend in California. He's going back to California, Tim. To California. To California. He's going back to California.
No, I don't think so.
You're right. He's not New Smyrna Beach, Florida. He's reporting the story. A Florida man is behind bars after he attempted to steal an airplane at the New Smyrna Beach Municipal Airport so he could fly to California to meet his girlfriend while carrying nearly 500 grams of marijuana, according to the New Smyrna Beach Police Department. On Saturday, officers were alerted that a stolen vehicle had been found at the airport, and while in the process of locating said vehicle, officers were flagged down by a man who said it was his vehicle that was stolen. The victim told officers that a man unknown to him jumped into the back of his truck and offered him $1,000 for a ride, according to a report. The man then got out of the truck but left a grinder, scale, and cell phone behind. Now, grinder, is that the sandwich, Tim?
No.
Or is this a drug paraphernalia?
The latter, Dave. It is not the former. Yeah, he didn't have a hoagie. He didn't have a grinder. He had a grinder, as in paraphernalia, tools.
You should have just stuck with a hoagie or grinder, navy bean, meatball sandwich, sloppy Joe. Yeah, I'm going down that road because I'm hungry, Tim. It's lunchtime here for me.
Oh, I bet it is. Yeah.
So he left a grinder, not the sandwich, a scale, and a cell phone behind. At the same time, the victim flagged down officers to describe the incident in the truck. Another officer at the airport was notified by a flight instructor that a man with a blue bag was spotted crouching on the wing of a plane station on a portion of the tarmac that was not accessible to the public. According to a report, the man asked the flight instructor how he could fly a plane. By the time officers reached the tarmac, the man was sitting in the right seat of the aircraft. When police officers approached him, he again asked if they knew how to fly a plane. The man then jumped from the emergency exit window of the plane and was detained by officers. After the man, identified as a 22-year-old named Robert Stenestra, was secured in the back of a patrol car, officers returned to the plane and took Stenestra's duffel bag into evidence. Officers said they found Stenestra's ID, sunglasses, headphones, cigarillos, because he's an OG gangsta, Tim. Two lighters, a pocket knife, and a laptop. A glass pipe was also found and tested positive for methamphetamine, a report showed.
Whoops.
Now, cigarillos, are those ones you crush out some of the cigarillo tobacco and you jam it with a little weed?
You got it.
That what we call a plunt?
A gunt? A blunt. Not a gunt.
I'm just asking.
That's something completely different. A blunt, Dave. A blunt.
A blunt.
Yeah, okay. Not a gunt. Right.
Next to the duffel bag was a container holding marijuana, investigators found. The defendant stated that he purchased the aircraft for $20,000 cash recently and was going to fly to California to meet his girlfriend, a report said. He advised he did not have paperwork and did not know the person from whom he bought it. That's sticky wickets. I bought it from eBay, and I don't remember the guy's name, but I believe his name was the Gunt Pilot 207. Yeah.
That's what he said?
Yeah. The defendant stated he was let onto the airfield by security. It should be known that there is no security on duty at that airport, which seems weird to me in a post 9/11 time that any airports are not secured, even small ones.
That would seem odd. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you think, you know, those little planes can do some damage, too, if they're flown into something.
Well, not only that, but you would think just smuggling anything. Arms,
yeah.
Drugs, you know, anything. Yeah.
Because he's got the smuggler's blues. While he was being processed, or processed, as we say in England, Stanestra told officers that he was the manager for a medical marijuana dispensary and that he was transporting the marijuana to California, according to a report. Investigators said Stanestra had nearly 500 grams of marijuana on him that he illegally trespassed on the New Smyrna Beach airport property. Stanestra was taken to the Volusia County Jail on charges of grand theft, possession of paraphernalia, trespassing in an operational area of an airport, possession of cannabis, and leaving the scene of a crash involving damage. Jail records show Stanestra is being held on how much bond, Tim, do you think, for 500 grams of marijuana, stealing a vehicle, causing an accident, trying to steal a plane, illegally accessing the airport. How much do you think his bond is for, Tim?
100 grand.
30 grand.
Jeez, they're light there.
That seems light to me.
Yeah.
Is it just that Florida jails are so packed?
I think so, yeah.
With Florida man that they're just like, we got to make it easier for them to get out.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
This is crazy. Huh. A man allegedly caught at airport with cocaine inside an artificial penis, Tim.
It's going to make it hard to get it out of there. I know that much.
I'm just going to shut up. A British man arrested in Brussels airport with cocaine inside of an artificial penis could face up to 3 years in prison for the offense, prosecutors said last week. The man was busted trying to smuggle the drugs from Jamaica into Belgium last February. That's what the New Zealand Herald reported. He allegedly told investigators that he intended to use the cocaine for personal use once he returned home. Oh, well, then it's okay, Tim. It's just cocaine for personal use.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what's the crime in that? Prosecutors did not prove the man who said he got the drugs while visiting his mom in the Caribbean county was a mule, but he was hung like a donkey, according to the report here. They asked for a 36-month sentence, the report said. Defense attorneys argued such a sentence is too severe since the man is in poor health. My client has kidney failure and needs to exercise as well as follow a proper diet. As I understand, there's a lot of exercising that takes place in prison, Tim.
Oh, yeah, there is.
And
yeah.
They feed you 3 squares a day.
They do.
And from my understanding, Tim, some prisoners eat better than guys like you and me.
That's what I hear. Yeah.
Well, maybe he should go to jail. So he had a fake penis packed with cocaine, Tim.
I mean,
what do you pack your fake penis with?
Twinkies.
I'm filled with Twinkies. Yes, yeah. Yes. Air high five, son. Boom. Right there. How sad is that? You and I have first, it's like cream-filled Twinkies.
You'd be amazed what happens if you accidentally sit down too fast.
Not actually.
Right, yeah. But yeah, it's not like the guy's going to use the cocaine in the fake appendage while he's sitting on the plane. I mean, if he could, he's a contortionist.
Well, we don't know how big said penis was. I'm just going to drop in your lap, Ron Jeremy. I mean, not really drop him in your lap, but
no,
I mean,
don't.
He was
able to, please. Yeah.
He could have snorted coke right out of that bad boy.
He could have. Yeah.
Speaking of, Ron Jeremy, a nude man is in custody after spending a night atop a railroad crossing sign in Eugene, Oregon. You heard that right, Tim. A man who spent the night perched nude atop a railroad crossing sign in Eugene jumped down and tried to make a run for it, only to be stopped by a law enforcement canine unit.
Oh.
You don't want your dangly bits out when there's a canine unit.
No.
Oh, Eugene police said the man who spent the night perched nude atop a railroad crossing sign attempted to run from police after more than 12 hours on the pole. Yeah. K-9 quick caught up to the suspect who was actively fighting the police dog when officers got to them. Police said the suspect put the dog in a headlock, punching it several times. Good grief.
Oh.
Officers arrested Brandon Lee Jackson, 39, of Eugene. He faces a long list of charges, really, for such a short Stay, Tim, if you know what I'm saying. Police said the situation started Monday night around 9:23 p.m. Officers responded to the 200 block of Washington Street regarding a nude male subject who had exposed himself to bystanders in the area and subsequently started throwing objects at two people and struck a male victim in the head with a rock. So maybe, Tim, this was just maybe you're right. Skynet has finally come to force.
I think so.
Only our John Connor in the future is kind of a moron and picked an idiot to send back in time and didn't plan it right. And the guy ended up on top of a crossing guard sign and he was ill-equipped as a Terminator. So he just threw rocks.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, dun, dun. Responding officers located the suspect who had climbed atop a railroad crossing sign. He remained there overnight. Boy, that's some grip.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
They called the crisis negotiators to make contact with the man. That's what she said. Shortly before 8 a.m., police asked motorists to avoid the area. A reporter at the scene saw the man get down from the railroad crossing sign and run. Officers caught up with him with the help of a police dog. He was in custody by 10:15 a.m. How terrified would you be, first of all, to be running naked? And then secondly, here behind you. Oh, gosh. Your dangly bits, Tim.
And then the first time the dog gets you. I mean, you know.
Obviously, you're tucking and holding, right? You're just like grabbing.
You have to.
Yeah.
Because the first time, it's not like the dog has these loving, gentle hands that grasp you lovingly and bring you down.
No. I got to guess the reason this guy got that dog in a headlock was because he was keeping the biting end away from his business end.
Yep. The dog had one target area and he was just saving it. I'm sorry.
Fort Wayne, Indiana, Tim. Mm-hmm. Because I need to move on from the story.
Yeah, please.
Huntington man is now in custody after police say he carjacked a Goodwill truck. That's irony right there, Tim. There's not much goodwill in what this man would. He then crashed it into a CityLink bus and then held a woman hostage using a fire extinguisher. Was this Curly from the Three Stooges? Just after 9:30 a.m., Fort Wayne police responded to the Goodwill on East State Boulevard, where a man carjacked a truck. A short time later, police said the suspect, later identified as 33-year-old Rue Miller of Huntington, crashed the stolen truck into a CityLink bus in the area of Hobson and Vance. Tim, Hobson and Vance.
Ooh.
That's when Miller got out of the Goodwill truck and left with a fire extinguisher. He had a plan. I'll give him that much.
Yeah.
Police said he tried to use that fire extinguisher to carjack another person, but police said the driver refused. No, that's a fire extinguisher, not a gun. I don't know if I want to catch a mouthful of powdery substance either, though.
No.
Mm-mm. And I'm not referring back to the story earlier with the man and penis filled with cocaine.
Trying to get your cocaine.
I guess I am. I'll just put this out there. I never want to be blasted in the face with powdery substance, no matter how it's delivered. Just out there. Police said he was screaming at officers, "Kill me!" Officers tried to get him to let go of the woman, but he refused. At that point, crisis negotiators and the emergency services team were called in to help. Eventually, Miller let the woman go, but he refused to put down the fire extinguisher. Police said she wasn't hurt. At that time, police said they shot less than lethal beanbag rounds at him and tased him. See, wouldn't that have been the better way with the guy that was naked? Instead of sending the dogs, what if you just hit him with beanbags? Right in the old gazinta.
Oh! Or one of those rubber bullets?
Tim, if you want to be, how do I want to say this? If you want to be incognito and commit crimes, let me give you one bit of advice. Do not get a machete tattooed on your face.
Yeah, probably not a good idea.
Because you will stand out. You can take some people at face value, Tim. That's how this article starts from Justin Couch. A Florida man with an apparent tattoo of a machete on his face apparent makes it sound like we're not quite sure. It is obviously a machete tattooed on his face, was arrested for allegedly attacking someone with, guess what, Tim?
A machete, Dave?
That's correct.
Ah, yeah.
He at least sticks to it. He's committed to the role.
Right.
Justin Couch, 25, is accused of slicing the victim's forearm with the blade, leaving him unable to move his left hand, according to the Hernando County Sheriff's Office. The victim, an adult man, said the incident started Monday at around 2:30 p.m. when Couch began arguing for no reason and kicked him out of his home in Tarrytown. When the victim asked if he could grab his wallet and cell phone before leaving, Couch allegedly told him, "There's nothing here for you. Leave." He then began striking the victim in the arm and leg with the flat side of the machete blade. Couch then swung the machete at the victim's face. This is how it starts, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Victim put his left forearm up to block his face and was sliced with the blade before feeling severe pain and passing out. Couch then apparently took the victim to an unknown friend's house who took the man to the hospital. Oof. So a story of a man going crazy wielding a machete, Tim. Mm. Just as we reach the time of year that I just want you to think about this, Tim. July, August, September, October, November, Tim. If you took the first letter of each one of those upcoming months, what does it spell, Tim?
July, August, September, October, November. Jason.
See what I'm saying?
It's Camp Crystal Lake season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Open, do you have your license, Tim? Open season on campers, I guess.
Yeah. Yep.
Yikes.
Never thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, our final story is here, Tim.
Okay.
A Godfather fan makes an offer that the police cannot refuse.
Uh-oh.
A suspect repeatedly identified himself as Michael Corleone. Was jailed for providing police, believe it or not, Tim, with a false name,
according
to the arrest affidavit. Florida cops allege that James Ransom, carrying open containers of natural light beer and Captain Morgan rum, caused a disturbance Thursday night on the boardwalk at Indian Rocks Beach, just west of St. Petersburg, Tim. Ransom, age 54, was allegedly seen accosting and yelling loudly at citizens, according to a sheriff's deputy. After being detained, Ransom repeatedly told the cops that his name was Michael Corleone. But when deputies did a computer checkup of the name, they came up empty. It was only after Ransom was submitted to a fingerprint scan that investigators confirmed he did not actually share a name with Al Pacino's character in the Godfather movies. Do you think at any point, Tim, at any point that they thought that that was the case?
No, they probably matched up with Fredo, though. Yeah.
In addition to being charged with providing a false name to law enforcement, Ransom was also cited for disorderly intoxication. Ransom yesterday pleaded no contest to both misdemeanor counts. After entering his plea, Ransom was released from the county jail after serving 2 days in custody. Ransom, who is listed as a transient in court records, has a rap sheet, Tim. How about that? Hard to believe. He has scores of arrests and convictions for crimes like drunk driving, disorderly conduct, trespassing, assault, grand theft auto, possession of drugs without a prescription, and battery on a law enforcement official, Tim.
Not good.
And I lied. Breaking news, Tim.
Uh-oh.
It just came into me. Breaking news.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Cassie Raylan Rowan, Tim.
Okay.
Yeah. Jail personnel in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Oklahoma, not Oklahoma. Tim.
Oklahoma?
And I'm probably saying Tahlequah wrong, too. But Tahlequah, Oklahoma, got an eyeful earlier this month when the 19-year-old was booked following her arrest for drunk driving. Rowan was collared late on Monday evening at Tahlequah Police Department by a Tahlequah Police Department officer scheduled for a hearing on a misdemeanor charge. Rowan's revealing top appears to be a favorite of hers. In a January 1st Instagram selfie, Rowan is pictured wearing the plunging garment. Okay. it's sexy, but is that the extent of that story? That's it, Tim.
That's it.
I guess they just wanted to share a picture of a gal with boobs.
Ah. Well,
and for it was, she was charged with drunk driving. And they felt like, oh, yeah, she's drunk driving and you can see her boobs. We should share this story. Huh. So not so much a dumb crime, stupid criminal, just a dumb crime for driving drunk and a, maybe a questionable dressed criminal.
Okay.
Is that the better way to say it?
Yeah, we'll take it.
All right. That's it for this week, kids. We are done with the Best in True Crime Talk Radio. We hope that you enjoyed it. We've got other great stories coming up for you over the month. I hope that you'll keep tuning in and checking it out with us. And I know we keep promising exciting news. I know we keep promising something big. And trust me, we want this completed as soon as possible as well. But things have been a little crazy, Tim. I don't know if you're aware of this. Riots, pandemics, murder hornets. Tim, dolphins with machine guns. The world has gone crazy.
Dolphins with machine guns?
Penises filled with cocaine, Tim.
Well, there's that.
Things are tying up the world right now, more important than the news we had. So we will be getting to that and hopefully getting things moving here soon. Just be patient with us, please. And hopefully all will be good. And I'm hoping that it's still July that we'll have this big announcement. And it's good news for you true crime aficionados, you fans of the show that have stuck with us. You're going to love what we've got to share with you coming up soon, especially with you, because, your support of this show has helped support our Darkness Radio program as well. We want to thank you personally for doing that and being a part of our world in such a saving grace. So thank you very much. And hopefully we'll be able to reward you very soon with some great news. But that's it for this week. You've been listening to the Best in True Crime Talk Radio. Remember, this Thursday, I'm hosting the special on Travel Channel with the cast of Kindred Spirits. So make sure you set your DVRs for that and check it out as I'm joined by Amy Bruni, Adam Berry, Chip Coffee, as we look back on a very powerful episode of Kindred Spirits, and we'll be discussing that on the Travel Channel, and that's this coming Thursday. I believe it's 9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. All right, stay safe, love one another. We'll be back with you again next Tuesday right here on True Crime Tuesday.